It does occur to me that if one is approaching the chapter meeting not from the point of view of a structure, but from the point of view of simply coming together and seeing what happens, what you are trying to allow to happen is the arising of that non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy. So that whatever you say, whatever you contribute, arises from those sort of depths, or at least arises from a depth that is not too far distant from that greater depth of the non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy. You're deliberately in that context, waiting to allow something to emerge from the deepest possible level, if possible, the level of the non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy. You're trying to allow the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara to manifest. And yes, we need in our own presence in the chapter to try to keep that idea of the chapter alive. And especially perhaps the chapter convener needs to be the guardian of that idea. Not the guardian of it by constantly telling other people about it, but the guardian of it by trying to live in accordance with that within the chapter oneself. And although this may be impossibly lofty, maybe in a way almost absurd for us to think in these terms, I think it's necessary for us to be absurd at times, and perhaps quite a lot of the time. We too often get bogged down in the details of things. We're trying to work out how you sort out disputes. We're trying to work out how you arrange what a chapter does, and so on and so forth. And we easily overlook the fact that what we're trying to achieve is total total mutual self-transcendence, so that we all simultaneously go beyond each other and allow the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara to take us over, so that the chapter becomes the manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. And really, we could say that the chapter is to be judged as successful or unsuccessful to the degree to which that stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy manifests within it. And I'm sure that if you reflect on your experience of being in a chapter, you will be able to point to times when there were moments, at least, of collective self-transcendence, when you really did feel that everybody in the chapter went beyond themselves, at least a little way, and that met in something that was more than merely egoistic, more than merely selfish. And one should do everything one can, both as an individual member of the chapter and especially as a chapter convener, to try to encourage that arising of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So that's the first sense in which I think the answer to the question, what is the order, is that the order is the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is the idea of the order in the most lofty sense. It's only when the groups of order members transcend themselves, giving themselves up to, being taken over by that stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy, that there really is an order. And even though often we're still in the foothills of spiritual life, merely sort of slogging away at ethics, at just being kind to each other, at being trying not to let our selfishness run too rampant, well, we are to that extent transcending ourselves, transcending our egoistic willing. And we are manifesting the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. At least we're experiencing something of his radiance manifesting through us, even if he hasn't, so to speak, been able to completely take possession of us. So that's the first sense in which the Bodhisattva is what the order really is. There's a second sense which is closely related to this. The order is the Bodhisattva because we are aspirant Bodhisattvas. And perhaps sometimes we forget this. We forget that as order members we have effectively committed ourselves to the Bodhisattva ideal. It's intrinsic to our ordination. It's not an add-on. It's not something that can be sort of bolted on if you choose to do so. It's absolutely integral to the act of spiritual commitment. Very straightforward. We know that ordination consists in going for refuge to the three jewels, effectively witnessed by someone else who's going for refuge to the three jewels effectively. Well, what does going for refuge to the three jewels mean? Well, you could approach that from many different points of view. But surely one of the most fundamental ways in which one could talk about it is that it means that you go beyond yourself. If you are going for refuge to the three jewels, you are not going for refuge to yourself. You're not going for refuge to your own egoistic willing. You're going for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. You're taking those as the essential basis of your life. And you're trying to let those guide you. You're trying to let them even dominate your volition, your willing. You're trying to become less and less selfish. That integral to going for refuge to the three jewels. Again, I think we easily forget this. We so often stress the aspects of individuality which are to do with taking possession of your own life. And we do that necessarily because it's quite a struggle for us. We're so often dominated by group processes, by conditioning and so on. We need to emphasize taking possession of our own lives and taking full responsibility for ourselves. But we take that responsibility in order to transcend ourselves, in order to go beyond ourselves, so that we cease to be merely the servants of an ego identity, and to become the servants of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, to allow the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara to manifest through us. So in going for refuge to the three jewels, in committing ourselves in the act of ordination, we are implicitly committing ourselves to the Bodhisattva ideal. There's no other possibility. You cannot go for refuge to the three jewels without transcending yourself, without becoming less selfish. This is why Bhante considers that we shouldn't think of the Bodhisattva ideal as being a sort of a forking path that you can take if you want to, as an alternative to the Arahat path. It's an unreal distinction. Going for refuge has integral to it an altruistic dimension, which is the Bodhisattva ideal. So each of us has implicitly committed ourselves to the Bodhisattva ideal in the act of ordination. Actually, it's a little bit more than implicit, it was explicit. After our ordination, we recited verses of acceptance at the end of the ordination ceremony, after the point at which we actually join the order, when the kesa is placed around our necks, we recite the verses of acceptance. And you remember that the final one of those verses of acceptance is, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So we've explicitly put our ordination in the context of all beings, that is, in the context of the Bodhisattva ideal. And Bhante has been saying recently that he thinks that not sufficient stress is laid on these verses of acceptance in general, and especially on the latter one. That people aren't sort of really sufficiently attentive to them. Maybe in the rush of events and in the kind of dramatic unfoldment of the ordination ceremony, it seems a little bit like an afterthought. You're everybody's so happy to have their kesa and to have their name broadcast and so on, you forget the fact that you've just taken the Bodhisattva vow. So it's quite easy for this to become sort of overlooked in the dramatic narrative of the ordination ceremony. And one might even think that perhaps it would be a good idea to amend the ordination ceremony so that element was placed more centrally. But perhaps there are other ways of doing that. Perhaps those who are conducting the ceremony need to pay special attention to this and draw it out more fully. I know Bante apparently did this recently in ordination that he did. So yes, we have explicitly committed ourselves to the Bodhisattva path in this verse of acceptance, and implicit in the very act of ordination itself is the Bodhisattva ideal. We need to see that our lives are working out that commitment. We need to be asking ourselves whether we are doing so. It's not just enough to be meditating and practicing the precepts in an ordinary sense. One needs to be feeling that one is, or even knowing that one is slowly transcending oneself, that one is less selfish. I know that recently there's been a lot of discussion about insight, and Bante's comment on that is that, well, in a way, insight is as insight does, and that it's not just a question of trying to work out whether you believe that somebody's had the insight experience or not because of the way they express it in words. The key is, are they less selfish than they were in their behavior? Are they manifesting selflessness in their behavior? If they're not, it doesn't matter what their supposed experience is. So, are we manifesting the Bodhisattva ideal more and more in our lives, insofar as that is integral to our ordination? Are we working to go for refuge? In working to go for refuge effectively, we're working with the effective arising of the bodhicitta. Bante talks about that as us being committed wholeheartedly to the bodhisattva ideal and making a serious effort to practice the six paramitas. If the bodhicitta has arisen effectively within us, we will be making a serious effort to practice the six paramitas. We will be making the bodhisattva ideal an integral part of our everyday lives. And, of course, we'll not merely be trying to make our going for refuge effective through making the arising of the bodhicitta effective. We'll be trying to turn that effective going for refuge and effective arising of the bodhisattva ideal, of the bodhicitta, into a real arising of the bodhicitta. We'll be trying to suffuse our actions with wisdom, so that the paramitas cease to be merely virtues and become paramitas in the full sense, because paramitas are paramitas by virtue of the presence of prajna. And of course, once prajna has suffused the paramitas, we can't fall back. So as individual order members, this is what we should be working at, because the bodhisattva ideal is integral, implicit in our ordination. And of course, the chapter is one of the principal arenas for going for refuge. It's in the chapter meeting that we especially meet with others simply as individuals who go for refuge to the three jewels. And of course, in the light of what we've just said, that means we become aware of each other as individuals who have effectively committed themselves to the bodhisattva ideal. So we're not simply aware of each other as individuals who have made a commitment to following a spiritual path. We're aware of each other as individuals who have committed ourselves to transcendence, self-transcendence, and to selflessness. And thereby we become more aware of ourselves as an individual who has committed himself to self-transcendence in the bodhisattva ideal. So through the chapter, one should become more aware of oneself in this way. One should become more aware of the bodhisattva dimension to one's commitment to the three jewels. That dimension should be reinforced. One's aspiration to live out the Bodhisattva ideal should be reinforced by one's presence in the chapter. And one should derive support and encouragement in practicing the Bodhisattva ideal from one's presence in the chapter. And furthermore, one should find from time to time that in the chapter, the actual experience of mutual self-transcendence takes place as the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara arises and everybody within the chapter becomes a hand, at least, of Avalokiteshvara. So in this way, the chapter becomes a very, very important arena for working out the altruistic dimension of one's going for refuge, and thereby for the arising of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So far I've dealt with the order as Bodhisattva in terms of the idea of the order is unity and harmony and self-transcendence, which means the arising of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Then I've dealt with it in terms of the commitment that we've each of us implicitly made in our ordination, which we should be striving to live up to and trying to make into the living reality of our lives as we are, so to speak, taken over by that stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy. But there's a third sense in which the order is the Bodhisattva. And this is much more practical or immediate or even historical. The order is, after all, the manifestation of a Bodhisattva vow. It's quite fortuitous that this little series is taking place after we've celebrated Dada Rinpoche's anniversary. Because, of course, it was from Dada Rinpoche that Bhante took the Bodhisattva vow. I know that Padmavajra talked about this yesterday. And, well, really, the order is the manifestation of Bhante's Bodhisattva vow. Whether implicitly or explicitly. Of course, Bhante does not believe anymore that there's a need for a Bodhisattva ordination. He believes that Bodhisattva vow is implicit in the act of going for refuge, in the ordination that we take. But nonetheless, Bhante did take a set of vows at his Bodhisattva ordination, and amongst those vows would have been a vow that is known in Buddhist tradition as the vow of Gana Parigraha, the vow to gather a Gana, which is a following of a people, if you like, to gather a community around him. And indeed, this aspect of the Bodhisattva vow is known as the Gana Parigraha Shilena, the ethics of gathering a following. And it's really a very, very important aspect of the whole discussion of the Bodhisattva in traditional sources. I'm particularly taking my references from Asanga's discussion in the Bodhisattva Bhumi. He explores a little bit what Gana Parigraha Shilena means. But it's the duty, you could say Shilena means duty really, the duty of the Bodhisattva to gather around him a community which he forms into a living culture, you might say. He provides that community, that gathering around him, with the institutions and resources that its members need in order to practice the spiritual life. He provides them with practices, and he offers them an ethical life which is, so to speak, culturally supported. The Bodhisattva Bhumi talks of the Bodhisattva disciplining beings. In other words, even providing punishment. I think perhaps we could talk about this. This is dangerous ground, so we better not pursue that line any further. But presumably what this really means is that within that culture, there is a strong encouragement and support for ethical action, and a discouragement and a support for a discouragement of unethical action and a support for confessing and making good unethical action. So that the culture itself is an ethical culture which supports a skillful way of life. So in this way, the duty of gathering a following, gathering a community, gana parigraha shilena, leads to the formation of, let's say, a movement and indeed an order. So Bhante, 40 years ago or more, took the Bodhisattva vow from Dada Rinpoche. Among those vows would have been gana parigraha shilena, and what he's done since then is directly and indirectly the manifestation of that vow. We are the manifestation of that vow. We are gathered. We have been gathered. And we are part of that following. We are part of that community. As a result of Bhante's Bodhisattva spirit, and perhaps especially because of his Bodhisattva vow. And so in that sense, the order is the manifestation of the Bodhisattva's aspiration, the Bodhisattva's vow. It's the manifestation of the Bodhicitta in this very real, practical, historical sense. Having been gathered into the community in the traditional expositions, what is it that happens to those who are gathered? Well, they themselves are led to the point at which they make the Bodhisattva vow, and they undertake gana parigraha shilena. They undertake the duty of gathering a community, so that the whole process is continued, is replicated. They are sparked off in turn to take the Bodhisattva vow and to do for others what has been done for them. So we have been gathered. In that gathering, we have been uplifted and inspired. We've been led to commit ourselves to the three jewels at our ordination, and thereby to take on the Bodhisattva vow. And an absolutely integral part of that Bodhisattva aspiration is a commitment to engage in gana parigraha shilena, to engage in the duty of gathering a following, gathering a community. Of course, insofar as we are not called upon to initiate such a community, but to support those who have initiated it, or he who has initiated it, our task is much easier. But nonetheless, it is a duty incumbent upon us by virtue of what we have received and by virtue of what we've undertaken. We need to engage in and participate in this process of gana parigraha shilena, of the duty of gathering a spiritual community. Well, how do we do that? Well, I think that we could say that the heart of the community is the order, and the heart of the order is the chapter. So our first duty, or the first aspect of gana parigraha shilena, is to help to gather the chapter, if you like. If the chapter is truly gathered, then the order will be truly gathered. If the order is truly gathered, then others will be gathered to it. And the effect of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara will be felt more and more widely. So if the duty of the chapter is to keep alive the Bodhisattva spirit, the spirit in which the order was founded, the spirit especially of gana parigraha shilena. So the order is the Bodhisattva. I hope I sufficiently established that from these three different points of view. And the chapter is the Bodhisattva. How is this to be realized? How are we to actually manifest the Bodhisattva? How are we to put into effect the Bodhisattva ideal? How are we to realize the order as the Bodhisattva? How are we to realize the order and chapter as the manifestation of this stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy. That is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. How are we to realize our commitment as chapter members to the Bodhisattva ideal? How are we to realize in the chapter the spirit in which the order was founded? How are we, in other words, to practice the ethics of gathering in relation to the chapter? How are we to practice that ethics of gathering in our relations with each other within the chapter? In the traditional expositions, the ethics of gathering is discussed in a number of different terms. But primarily, it's discussed in terms of the four Sangrahavastus, the means of unification, as it's called. But you can see that immediately the connection is, even in the Sanskrit, parigraha means gathering from around, as it were. Sangraha means gathering together. Sang means sort of unifying, gathering together. So the Sangravastus are the means to practice Gana Parigraha Shilena. They're ways of realizing the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, of practicing our commitment to the Bodhisattva ideal, and of putting into effect the spirit in which the order was founded. And as you probably all remember, they are first of all dana, which is generosity. Secondly, priyavadita, which is loving speech. Thirdly, artacharya, which is beneficial activity. And fourthly, samanatata, which is exemplification. So generosity, loving speech, beneficial activity, an exemplification. If you want to gather a community, you engage in these four Sangrahavastus. And you can probably fairly immediately see that if you're really practicing those, well, the effect is to overcome barriers between people. The effect is to draw people together. The effect is to unify them, to unite them, to harmonize them. If you practice generosity, well, people are unified, are harmonized. If you practice loving speech, people are attracted, are drawn together. If you practice beneficial activity, well, people will be benefited and uplifted, made happy, and want to unite. If you exemplify spiritual principles, well, people will gain the confidence to live in accordance with the spiritual ideal, to become members of the spiritual community. One practices these four Sangrahavastus, and they attract people. They draw people to them. They're the kind of behavior, the kind of manifestation of human activity, which people will find themselves drawn to. They'll want to come closer. They'll want to be part of it. And having become drawn closer, well, they'll be drawn further and further in until they become part of it all. And once they become part of it all, they'll be drawn into deeper and deeper communication with those within that community. And they'll be led to transcend themselves. They'll forget themselves more and more in the spirit of the Bodhisattva that is uniting people, that is drawing people. And they'll experience that third order of consciousness, which is neither the group consciousness nor the individual consciousness, but something higher and beyond them. And they'll literally be the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So the Sangrahavastus are the means for the realization of the order as Bodhisattva. They're the means, of course, obviously, in terms of our doing classes and putting up posters and trying to attract people to a center and so on. But even more fundamentally, they're the means within our chapter. Because if the chapters are not united, if the chapters are not to some degree the manifestation of the Bodhisattva, our activities in centres will not really be effective. So the process of gathering needs to begin with us. We need to gather more closely. We need to realise a level of gathering which is transcendental. So over these next days, I'm going to look at each of the four Sangrahavastus. I'm going to look today at Dana, and then the other three over the next 3 days. I'm not going to be able to deal with Dana in any very great depth, but I hope that I can draw out at least a few reflections that are applicable to one's presence in the chapter. Because what I'm suggesting is that as a chapter convener, you can be reflecting all the time on the extent to which the Sangrahavastus are being put into practice within the chapter. It's then, of course, the way in which you put them into practice, if you feel they're not being put into practice, is in your own actions. But as the chapter convener, perhaps you have an even more intense duty than others to be working with the Sangrahavastus. The chapter will not be a chapter. It will not manifest the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara unless the Sangrahavastus are present. So I'm suggesting that they give us both a clue as to how to work, especially as chapter conveners, but they also give us a clue as to how to test the effectiveness of the chapter. So whilst I've started, I hope, from the loftiest of perspectives, I also hope that I'm going to give you the most practical of tools. So how does Dana, the Sangrahavastu of Dana, work within the chapter? First of all, let me just sort of draw out a little bit what Dana represents. This is fairly well-worn ground, so I'm not going to go into it in any great depth and detail. But of course, every act of Dana, every act of generosity, however small and however grudging, so to speak, is an act of self-transcendence. In giving to somebody else something that you have, well, you're overcoming your ego to some extent. And sometimes it can be a very powerful practice of self-transcendence. Sometimes you can give something away that means a lot to you, and then in a certain sense you don't want to give away. But in the act of successfully giving it away, you do triumph over yourself, over your self-attachment. And you do experience a release of, non-egoistic energy. And sometimes the experience of Dana can be like that. You can experience, after giving, a kind of release, a kind of surge of energy, very joyful and uplifted, which takes you at least somewhat beyond yourself. So for the giver, the act of Dana takes one beyond oneself. But it also, of course, has an effect on the person to whom something is given. When something is given to you, if you're at all sensitive, you will feel that the barrier has been broken down between you and the other person in the gift, whatever it may be. You feel that the other person has taken you into consideration and has broken down to that extent the barrier between self and other. So from the point of view of the one who is given to, the act of Dana is one that breaks down barriers, the barrier of self and other, so that one feels that other is not just a competitor who one needs to be careful doesn't take advantage of one. One feels that the other is another self and joins you, as it were, to some extent on your side of the divide. So that in this way, acts of generosity are, by definition, unifying. They're Sangrahavastus because they break down the distinction between self and other in the act of generosity, both giver and receiver, are led to a little beyond themselves, or at least to see the barrier between them attenuated. But it can be very, very impressive, even in quite small acts of generosity, the way in which that barrier is broken. Sometimes you can give to somebody who maybe has not good feelings about you, and you can resolve everything just in that gift. And I think that probably we need to think more in terms of this sort of act as a means of resolving disputes than talking it all out. I'm sorry, I'm beginning to get fed up with that, even though we don't do it enough. If you see what I mean. We just go on and on and on, talking endlessly. Ours is a culture that generates words, by the yard. Well, not by the yard, of course, by the meter, I'm sorry. And by the kilo. And actually, often, words are not what is needed. What is needed is an act. And the act that is needed is dana. You just go out of your way to give to the person who is perhaps conceives themselves, or you conceive, as your enemy. And in that one gift, you can leap over volumes of words. Well, in a way, I'm already straying into my subject. How do we apply this to the chapter? I'm going to approach this quite simply, and perhaps rather obviously, but, what else can I do? How do you practice the Sangraha Vastu of Dana in relation to your chapter? Well, the first thing is you go there. And you go there in a spirit of dana. You give your presence. Now, this might seem quite an odd thing to say, but actually what we hear in our chapter retreats is people wondering whether there's any value in the chapter for them from time to time. Not very many people, but from time to time people think like this. Or you hear somebody withdrawing from a chapter because, I can't see, I don't get anything out of it. But we've taken the Bodhisattva vow. We're trying to manifest this stream of non-egoistic doodahs and what's-its. Surely, it's not a question of going there and saying, there's nothing for me in this. So we need to think of our actual presence there as an act of dana. Not, I'm very good, I've given myself. But just a simple, straightforward going there in a generous spirit. Here I am. I'm here, as it were, as much for your sake as for mine. I think that implies not just your presence, but a certain sort of spirit and an atmosphere. And you notice this sometimes, don't you? You just feel that somebody's there in a very, very generous way. That they're completely present. They brought themselves there fully and completely, and they're very open to everybody else. And they're very pleasing in their presence, very friendly, but very polite and in the best sense of the term, polite in the sense of being sensitive to other people. Of course, being sensitive to other people can sometimes mean being impolite, if you see what I mean. You can think about that. But yes, one's presence is a pleasing presence, perhaps even pleasing in the way one looks, so that one's actually sort of made sure that one presents oneself in a way that it's pleasing for other people to look at. I think this is something about dress that we don't often take seriously in the West. And you get a bit of a shock when you go to India, that the way in which people would not dream of dressing the way some of us dress. Because it just seems so, sort of lacking in self confidence and pride. But be that as it may, I think that at least one should present oneself in a way that's pleasing to the eye of others, if one can. So that also presenting oneself, appearing, giving your presence fresh, if you possibly can, so that you're there in a good state. Wide awake, your mind fresh and alert, and attentive to everybody around you. So, your presence, but not your mere presence, your presence as a kind of act of generosity, taking the others into consideration. And perhaps above all, the chapter convener needs to give his presence in this sort of sense. And maybe, in a way, that's all one needs to say. If one really gave one's presence in that way, well, then everything else would follow, all the other acts of generosity implicit in the Sangrahavastu of Dana in the chapter would follow. But let me fill it out. I think the second thing that one should draw attention to is just the very practical one of actual gifts. Bhante, I remember saying that he thought that if the spiritual community was really alive, it would be characterized by the constant exchange of gifts. And people would be always giving things to each other, literal things, flowers, books, little gifts and big gifts. And they would be constantly part of the exchange between people. And perhaps this is something that we, certainly on the men's side of the order here in England, could do a lot better. It is, and this is not a hint, by the way, but it's very noticeable with the chapter retreats at Majumaloka, that the women's chapter retreats always end with lots of chocolates and flowers. Sometimes the men's do, but when I say not enough, I don't mean that we don't get enough chocolates, but that it's obvious that gratitude is felt, but it's not manifested as spontaneously and naturally and readily. And this is no doubt to do with something both biological and cultural. But perhaps we need to reflect on that and need to work at giving in the literal sense of exchanging gifts. And it's quite extraordinary what gifts do. You just reflect on your own experience of being given something, even a small thing. Somebody comes to see you and gives you even a card or a flower or something like that. Well, it has an effect upon you. I certainly know this in India, that nobody would dream of coming to see you without bringing a flower. And, I see a lot of people in India, and often my shrine is just a sort of heap of flowers, because everybody comes, just picks a flower on their way and gives it to me. And it never becomes routine, it never becomes automatic. They always give it with great feeling, and I always receive it as, a token of real feeling. So I think we shouldn't overlook this aspect of things, and perhaps the chapter conveners could reflect on whether it might not be a good idea from time to time for you to come to your chapter meeting and give everybody a flower. Just see what happens. Perhaps especially when things have been rather difficult. Just pull out of your bag, a bunch of Smarties. Those are sweets, by the way, for the or whatever. COVID is wonderful like this. Suddenly in the middle of a meeting, you dive into his bag and he's got a whole confectionery shop in his room. And he just starts distributing sweets to everybody. And another friend who comes to my Kudananda, he always very, very carefully makes sure that in tea breaks and so forth, there are biscuits and things like that. So, yes, actual gifts, I think, can be a very real a breaker down of barriers and I think especially when things are a bit difficult, change the atmosphere. So don't forget gifts in the quite literal sense. Of course, the chapter can also give gifts in a much bigger sense when it's seen that people are in need, when they're in real difficulties. The chapter can rally round and give. And it should be sort of part of the culture of the chapter that kind of generosity is really very much ready. It's not something you have to dredge up. It's just automatic. Somebody's got difficulty. Everybody just says, "Oh, well, can we help? Let me, know your bank account." Well, you should know it already, of course. And so on. So actual gifts are a means of unification, and especially when there's difficulty. Don't be ashamed to just pull out the gifts when there's been a tough order meeting. At the beginning of the next one, everybody comes in a bit fearful and so forth, and you're there with, you know, some sweets or some cake or something like that. It will change the atmosphere. And it's not a trick. It's a manifestation of your real care and your real sympathy and your feeling for harmony. Thirdly, really extending this point, into helpful acts. All the time in the chapter, the little things that need doing. For instance, somebody comes, there's no chair for them. Well, you leap up and give them your chair and go and get another one yourself. The tea needs making. Well, you just jump up and do it. Don't think to yourself, well, I always make the tea. Just do it and sort of manifest that generous spirit. Somebody's needed to ring up somebody and tell them about the next meeting, what's going to be done. Well, you just volunteer and be an exemplifier of this sort of spirit. Have what in India is delightfully called helping nature. So you just try to sort of live that out and be on the lookout for opportunities to give in this sort of way. And there surely are 100 opportunities every meeting for this kind of helpfulness. Just remember how profound this is. All the time we're talking about quite simple things, but they have very profound significance, because what you're trying to do is to gather the spiritual community. You're trying to gather the chapter into closer and closer harmony so that this stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy can manifest and take over. That's why you're doing it. You don't think about the fact that you are always doing it and nobody else does. You don't think about the fact that, if you do it, somebody else might. You just do it. Then fourthly, of course, perhaps one of the most important acts of dana that you have is listening, is paying attention to others, being aware of them in the first place, because it may not even be a question of listening to what anybody's saying. There may be silence, but you're giving your attention. You are aware of everybody. Of course, if you're really aware of them, well, you're lessening your attention to the insistent voice of your own demands. Most of the time, we're going around listening mainly to ourselves, to what we want. Of course, often not in a very really genuinely attentive way. But if we really listen to other people or pay attention to other people, we transcend ourselves. We lessen our attention to the insistent voice of self-cherishing. So we listen. We pay attention to others. And when they speak, we really listen to them. Really listening means trying to hear what they say and not just sort of remaining silent until they finish so you can say what you're preparing to say. Very often what you get in a meeting where there isn't this kind of listening going on, people just coming in almost over the top of each other because they've been preparing what to say while the other person is talking. You listen. You listen carefully. I think in a meeting, any kind of meeting, where there is this kind of attention, there will naturally be a silence after somebody's spoken, because you'll be moving from hearing them to reflecting upon what they say to speaking in response. Of course, it goes on a little simultaneously, but one needs to be careful that one doesn't just spend one time thinking what you're going to say. And if one isn't doing that, there's a natural rhythm to things. Speech, pause, speech, pause, and so on. And there's a sort of a gap, a spaciousness that is to the discussion, so that you can really listen and then really reflect. So give your attention and listen to what the other is saying. give full attention so that you hear quite carefully and accurately what they say. Giving attention in this sense, listening to the other person in this sense, means also clarifying what they say. So that sometimes the best gift you can give is question. Because a question shows, or is a manifestation, of your desire to understand. This person has spoken, it's not entirely clear to you what they mean, either because there's some confusion in what they've said, or because it's not fully explicit. So your questions are your gift to them. They are the manifestation of your interest in them and your attention to what they're saying. And to be asked questions in that way can be very, very, very pleasing. If somebody really shows that they want to know what you mean, what you're saying, you can feel very much sort of united with them, very much in sympathy with them. And of course, often you're able to explain yourself much better, much more deeply, because somebody's given you that kind of attention. One could go on down that line. If you do give advice, well, you make sure that the advice or the comment that you make is really related to what the person has actually said, and that takes into account fully what they're meaning, and isn't just, you know, your own sort of immediate association in your own experience with what they've said. They're a different person to you. Their experience is different and unfolds in a different way. There may be analogies in your experience, but you need to be very careful not to speak merely from that analogy until you're very sure that the analogy is applicable. You need to, first of all, be paying attention to them and their experience as a unique individual, and recognizing that their unique individuality may mean that similar actions, similar feelings mean something quite different in their experience. And so again, you give to them your full attention without a shallow reference to yourself. And you give to them your attempt to really understand them and to really offer something to them that can be helpful to them. I think usually, in my experience, comment is not necessary. Often I think we're too ready to comment. And, some people, and I think I'm probably of this kind myself, take a kind of chess, crossword puzzle solver's delight in sorting out other people's problems. It's an intellectual conundrum, and one has to be very careful not to just kind of get involved in that sort of way, out of the delight in the intellectual problem solving of it. I didn't mean to be self-disclosing here. But yes, you need to make sure that what you're doing is really attentive to them and what they need. And often all they need is your attention. They just need you to hear them and to understand deeply what it is they're saying. Perhaps what you can do is ask them a few questions, for instance, in relation to a confession. Well, you're asking them, why did this happen? What have you done about it? What are you going to do in the future? Those sort of questions. But again, with sympathy, with sensitivity. So that is what you can give to others in the chapter. And if everybody's giving in this sort of way, there will be a very, very positive atmosphere indeed. Even in the midst of very difficult disclosures, there can be some of the most uplifting meetings because of the quality of the attention that's given and the quality of the honesty and openness of the one who's speaking. So then, fifthly, in the unfolding of the meeting, you can give mindfulness to the flow of the meeting. And perhaps this is especially important for the chapter convener. As Bhante's pointed out again and again, the chapter convener doesn't have a duty that others don't have, but he has the duties that others have to a greater extent, if you see what I mean. Everybody's responsible for the conduct of the meeting, but the chapter convener is especially responsible. Responsible at least for reminding others of their responsibility. So, yes, you need, as a chapter convener, and indeed as a chapter member, to remain mindful of what is happening. You're constantly mindful of what you're trying to do in the chapter, of where the chapter meeting is going. So you're giving your mindful attention to the context of the chapter, samprajanya, if you like. What is the meeting trying to do? Where is it going? What is the nature of the present discussion and conversation? Is it really coming from the depth that are worthy of this chapter? Or has it become superficial in a way that the chapter is quite capable of going beyond? Is the chapter meeting really moving towards the manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara? Is what is being said just scattering energy and leading into a superficial and kind of heady conversation? So you remain mindful in this sort of way of the overall flow of the conversation of the chapter meeting. You remain mindful of the general state of the meeting and of where it's going. And perhaps as a chapter convener, you especially need to be developing this sort of sensitivity to what's happening, or at least reminding people as best you can of the need for that. And it's not a question of blundering in with, I think, when being rather superficial here. That often just makes things even more superficial. But of sort of coming in a way that takes things deeper. I spoke quite a bit last year, I think, of the way in which a chapter is as strong as its strongest member. And that the order is so responsive, generally. And I think chapter meetings are likewise very responsive. If somebody speaks from sincerity and depth, others will, on the whole, respond with sincerity and depth. So if you feel things are becoming superficial, it's no good blurting out, I feel we're becoming superficial. Because some people will say, oh, no, we're not. Or we'll feel that, are you getting at me? And so on and so forth. It just doesn't work, generally speaking. You might reflect on it a bit later, but in the flow of things, that sort of clumsy intervention usually just makes things worse. But you just speak with greater depth. And it has you'll find it has a dramatic effect. You just come in from another perspective, and you will find, on the whole, that people respond. And if people, you know, won't listen or whatever, will you say, "I'm sorry, can you just hold on a minute? I just want to say something." And you take the initiative to bring things onto a deeper level. Of course, this demands great sensitivity and skill, and one won't always get it right. But it's part of what one can give to the chapter, is your responsibility to the chapter, to the atmosphere of the chapter as a whole. As I say, every chapter member should be thinking in these terms, but especially the chapter convener should. And perhaps at times you may need to initiate a discussion about these sort of issues, but you do that in a way that's not going to just polarise and look like an accusation against somebody in particular. Or if there is something that needs to be taken up with somebody in particular, you do it in as helpful a spirit as you possibly can. So you give that kind of mindfulness and that kind of initiative. Well, finally, of course, you give to the chapter what every chapter member should be giving. You give confession and confidence. And you give those confessions and confidences, especially when it seems the atmosphere isn't right for it, if you see what I mean. If you feel that, things have become a bit superficial, well, you don't then think, oh, well, I'm not going to confess now. You plunge on, and you deliberately make sure that, well, you deliberately speak out, and you try to inject that sort of deeper note. So this is an aspect there of what I've already talked about in terms of take initiative. I think too often we've discovered in the chapter retreats we've been having that where people have not been having some kind of structure to their discussion, what they say is that there's less confession often, and that sometimes the mood for confession has gone. Well, personally, I just don't accept that, because it's up to the individual. If you've got something to confess, well, you confess, and I'm sure that people will respond. Even if the conversation is sort of, you know, the mood has become a bit more discursive or whatever. Well, you don't have to become more discursive. And you just come in the appropriate sort of way. You say, well, before we go any further, there is something I wanted to talk about. I want to make a confession. And I think you'll find that fairly quickly everybody sort of slows down and gets into receiving confession mode, as it were. They will be responsive. And if they're not, well, then at some point you're going to need to discuss that. But that the initiative rests with you. And yes, your initiative as a chapter member rests in being prepared to confess and confide when that seems appropriate. And especially as a chapter convener, it's your duty, part of your gana parigraha shilena, is to offer your own confessions and confidences, perhaps even especially when it doesn't seem that the mood is quite deep enough for it, because it's your contribution to taking it deeper. Of course, one might also say, finally, that one of the things that you have to contribute to the meeting is a non-contribution. If you've got nothing to contribute, well, don't contribute it, if you see what I mean. Don't feel obliged to say something. One of the things that we've noticed, again, with the meetings where there's no formal structure, is that people seem to easily fall into the idea that it's just unstructured reporting in. Well, you don't have to say anything. You can benefit enormously from the meeting without saying a word, just by attending to it, just by really taking everybody else in. Not because you're holding back, not because you're afraid to speak, not because you're trying to cover up, but because, at the moment, you've genuinely nothing to say. And you can participate fully and extremely effectively in the chapter meeting just by being there and attending carefully to what everybody says. And I think this is perhaps something that our self-expression culture tends to go against. We tend to feel that we've not really been present unless we've spoken. Well, that can be the case. Sometimes people exclude themselves by not speaking and then feel that they haven't really been present. But that's not necessary. You can take a fully individual and responsible part in the meeting, benefit very deeply from it without uttering a word. And if you haven't got anything to say, the best thing you can do is to keep quiet and let those who have something to say, say it. And so I would say that your final contribution to the chapter meeting may be your silence. At times, perhaps even often, it is going to be your silence. Holding back, waiting until you've really got something to say and the moment is ripe for it. I have seen people very effectively participate in discussions and so forth, saying very little indeed, but just observing it. You sense the quality of their attention to what's going on, and you feel a call to speak more accurately, more deeply, more truthfully, because of the way in which they're attending. So let's not always think that contributing means saying something. Contributing can mean remaining silent, but in a real and meaningful silence. And it may be even that you all fall silent together, and that you all share your silence with each other, and that in that silence, well, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara really does begin to manifest. So in these, and I'm sure there are other ways, dana can be a real contribution, can be a means to unifying the chapter. If you take seriously this sangrahavastu of dana, I'm sure that the chapter will flourish even more than it's done before. The means of unification are very serious tools for the bringing about of unification. And unification, in the end, is the manifestation of that non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy. So if we all have an attitude of generosity, Avalokiteshvara will literally manifest, and the order will be the Bodhisattva in that sense. If we take seriously the attitude of generosity, we will fulfill the commitment implicit in our ordination to the Bodhisattva ideal, and begin to manifest as a hand or even a face of Avalokiteshvara. And if we take seriously this attitude of generosity, the chapter will be united and harmonized, and will increasingly transcend the individual egos within it and become in itself a manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara.